I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, April 1st. Relax, listener, this podcast contains no pranks, jokes or seasonal deception. Not only would it be in poor taste given the subject matter of pandemic, you may not even be listening on April 1st, so it might only lead to confusion. So on our 82nd episode, we spent the last three looking at Europe's contractual, political, epidemiological and immunological woes. In this episode, we're looking at Israel. Israel is just coming out of an election campaign for its 120-seat parliament, the Knesset. It's the fourth trip to the polls in 2 years, and it was an election held in the midst of a very successful vaccination programme. In fact, the most successful in the world. It hasn't all been rosy. There has been criticism of Israel's failure to administer or supply vaccines more widely to Palestinians who live under its control in the occupied territories. We're going to look at some of the wider issues of the vaccination programme now with the military and defence analyst of the Israeli Daily newspaper Haaretz, Amos Harel, somewhat of a regular on this podcast over the past while. He's been using his analytical skills on COVID-19 for the past year or so. Okay, so first off, how are you? It's been a busy couple of weeks on all fronts in Israel. Have you recovered from the dizzying maelstrom of rapid vaccinations and a full-on election campaign?
The bright side is the vaccination campaign. It's going on quite magnificently, and there are mostly good news. It's one of the only places in the world when you can actually talk really good news. On the other hand, the political situation is, as usual with Israel recently, quite a mess. It's still unclear what the actual implications of the last round of elections are going to be and if there is any chance of establishing a stable government in Israel.
Right. Well, let's stick with the good news first then. I'm nearly reluctant to ask you about the rate of vaccinations in case it's already out of date by the time I publish this podcast this evening. But as far as you know it, how good is the news at the moment on vaccination rates and the rollout of people with first and second jabs?
So first jab, more than 56% of the Israelis have received at least one jab. And in fact, more than 51% have received both jabs of the vaccine. So this is quite remarkable when you consider the fact that Pfizer, which produces the vaccines that Israel is supplying to its population, has limited the age to over 16. So if you look at the numbers, people over 50 in Israel, 90% were either vaccinated or have been ill and recovered. I think it's about 85 or 86% of these were actually vaccinated. And then you have 80% of the people over 16 year old. And since Pfizer yesterday announced that there were good results from its trials for 12 to 16 years of age, it's assumed, and since Israel is working, as you know, quite efficiently on the vaccine campaign, it's assumed that by May, we will have children between the ages of 12 to 16 will begin getting their vaccines. So if I look at my own family, for instance, four of us have already been vaccinated twice. Two of my kids are 22-year-old and 17. And the youngest of the bunch, who's 14, will probably receive his first jab by May. So from our family's point of view, this crisis may be almost over by June. So this is quite remarkable.
Right. And Israel has had a remarkable stroke of good fortune in that it went all in on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. And that's the very one that is showing up positive results for children between the age of 12 and 15. Plus, it has a pretty young population. So for achieving herd immunity, Israel has really fallen on its feet in terms of its choice of vaccine.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. And I could also say that I think we've discussed that the last time we talked, that the health system here is quite efficient. In the end, Israelis tend to complain. We always complain. But in the end, the system here, that the health organizations, the way they collect data, the way they deal with patients and so on, it's extremely well suited to the vaccination campaign. And we have to give credit to the prime minister. I'm not a fan, as I've mentioned in the past, not a Netanyahu supporter, but he was quick to identify that this was the path forwards for Israel, that there was no point in dreaming of an Israeli version of zero COVID, that this wouldn't work here. The population, if you'd like, is not disciplined enough to behave that way. We cannot act like Australia or New Zealand or Taiwan. Also, there's the issue of the Palestinians in the nearby territories. We'll probably talk about that in a few moments. So for all these reasons, the way forward for Israel and for Netanyahu was to go all in with the vaccination campaign. Now, if we look at the actual results right now, we've mentioned the numbers of people who received the vaccines. Perhaps even more important is the actual transformation occurring COVID itself in Israel. There were details of yesterday's numbers just published a few minutes ago. It's around 450 Israelis a day who are now considered ill with the virus. These are very small numbers if you consider the fact that 2 months ago we were around 9,000 cases a day. So I'm not sure if you've reached the herd immunity. Some scientists claim that this has already happened because if you combine the numbers of the people who received vaccines with the people who are actually ill, and it's assumed that it's around 15% of the population, then you probably reach the threshold of around 70%. So I would assume, again, it's a wild guess and I'm not a scientist, I would assume that we are approaching herd immunity or somewhere close to that in Israel. This is quite a change. And perhaps Israel, I would guess that Israel would be the first in the world to achieve that because of the success of the vaccination campaign.
Right. I was reading actually in your own paper, I think yesterday, that one of your colleagues was looking at the issue of herd immunity. And the only concern is your neighbors, the Palestinians on the West Bank in particular, where there is greater movement back and forth between the West Bank and Israel, and also Gaza, where there's obviously less movement there. The Palestinians so far are getting vaccines from COVAX. They've had some for their health workers donated from Israel, and there's been vaccinations of Palestinians working within Israel and on the settlements. Is that the case? But the idea of a more broad rollout to the West Bank at the moment is not being countenanced by the government.
Look, I think that the government was mistaken here, and it has to do with politics as well. And you have to remember that Netanyahu leads a right-wing government that's deeply tied to settlers' organizations and so on. In the end, the right thing to do, not only from a human point of view, a human interest point of view, if you'd like, or human rights, would be to help your friends, help your neighbors, even if you consider them to be frenemies or whatever you'd like to call them, considering the unstable relationship between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. We took an important step forward with the fact that more than 100,000 Palestinian workers were vaccinated. Most of them, I think, received already two jabs in recent weeks. And this is important because these are exactly the people who are going back and forth between the territories and the Israeli settlements or Israel itself as well within the 67 borders. So this is important. But yet the situation itself, especially in the West Bank, is quite critical right now. There are a lot of deaths, a lot of cases. It's assumed that within a month or two, they will receive more and more vaccines. Some of this maybe through the World Health Organization. There's talk of the Chinese vaccine or the Russian vaccine arriving as well. I would hope that by summer, the West Bank would be over this and hopefully in a similar situation to Israel. But this is going too slow, and the Palestinians are paying a huge cost for this. And it's also dangerous for Israel because in the end, Israel is not an island state. It does not live in a bubble. It cannot control all of the gates of entrance to the country exactly because of the particular situation between Israel and the West Bank. And therefore, I think there's an obligation for us to help as much as possible in order to solve this. Gaza is another issue because Israel has withdrawn from Gaza, as you may remember, with the disengagement plan in 2005. And this becomes a political issue because Israel says, look, this is not our problem anymore. While most of the international community are saying you still have a moral obligation because Gaza is practically in a state of siege because both of its borders to Israel and to Egypt are closed. We'll have to see about that. I think that the highest priority would be to help the West Bank as quickly as possible. And since it appears that there are many, many vaccines being collected in Israel and so there are so many deals that were signed, I think Israel could probably help more regarding Gaza as well, in spite of the fact that there's quite a level of animosity between Israel and the Hamas regime in the Gaza Strip.
Well, I was going to just touch on what you mentioned there. It probably is harder for Israel to argue its case that, you know, it's not its responsibility when it has such a surplus of vaccines. So maybe you could talk me through why Israel has such a surplus of vaccines. And first off, the reason it's giving for not rolling it out to the West Bank, but also then this idea of having so many vaccines, what's the rationale behind that?
I think it began quite normally, as I said, because Netanyahu was quick to spot the problem and the solution for that. And he applied a lot of pressure on both the CEOs of Moderna and Pfizer in order to push Israel ahead and have it positioned at the front of the line. And I think that both companies felt that that was a good deal for them as well because of the issues I've mentioned, the fact that Israel is very efficient at controlling and collecting its health data and so on, and the presumption, which turned out to be true, that Israel could quickly roll out a vaccination campaign for most of its population. So this is what happened.
Everybody now likes to back a success story.
Yeah, of course. And it's extremely helpful for Pfizer as well. Think of this. Pfizer had the best trial possible. I mean, it got the only reason we're talking right now and that this is interesting for your Irish listeners is because Israel right now is a success story. And that's good for Pfizer as well, because other countries who are deliberating which vaccines should we buy for the next years and so on are probably saying to themselves, the leaders there are saying to themselves, I want what he's having. I want what Netanyahu did. I want to reach the same results with my own population in order to get out of this crisis and out of this mess. Right now, I think Netanyahu, which is typical for him, Netanyahu is an alarmist. He always tends to look at the most pessimistic scenario. And he's pushing forward this idea that for some reason Israel needs no less than 36 million jabs of vaccines for the next year or so. Why? Nobody can explain exactly, because it's not even clear whether you need a boost of this vaccine within a year's time. The scientists still don't know. But right now, he's pushing forward as much as he can with this idea that we need to buy more vaccines and we need to do it fast. Some of his political opponents are saying that he's using this for political reasons and that there's no real reason to buy so many vaccines right now. Personally, I think that Israel should move forward as quickly as possible with the West Bank, because it's the humane thing to do, but it's also instrumentally, it's the right thing to do in order to push us through this threshold of herd immunity. Because if we don't do that, we won't be able to separate completely between the two populations. We have a certain moral obligation, in my view, to help the Palestinians, but we would also be helping ourselves.
Has there been any controversy at all about, given that, as you say, the massive surplus in vaccines coming down the tracks, that there has been proposals to give vaccines to the Czech Republic, Rwanda, Honduras, Guatemala? It seems to possibly have the potential to raise eyebrows amongst the vaccine manufacturing companies who were of the understanding they were supplying Israel alone.
Yes, but again, these are symbolic numbers. My personal view is that this is a mistake, that Israel should not be dealing with this in such a manner, that the numbers are not significant enough to have any kind of importance on the one hand, and on the other, that we should not make neither the producers themselves angry about this. And also, as you said, we have to consider the fact that the Palestinians are still waiting in line for their vaccines. In my view, this is not the right policy to go forward with. And there were objections here as well. It got to a point where the Attorney General has told Netanyahu that he has to stop with this policy and that this needs to be discussed either by the Attorney General or the Supreme Court in order to figure out what the agenda is and what the priorities are. But it's, again, this is typical for Netanyahu. Even when he does a very good thing and moves forward with the vaccination campaign, there are always the political tricks behind the scenes where he's trying to achieve some other goal, which is usually something that is unclear to the public or the media or his political opponents. And there's always a shady way of dealing with such matters. So we're not really surprised that this was discovered. But I don't think this is the right way forward for Israel.
In Ireland at the moment, there's a running controversy because the way that vaccinations are being rolled out has been changed. It was going to be rolled out to vulnerable cohorts of the population first and then by profession. That's been changed and it's been rolled out by age, which is being debated at the moment. How did Israel do it? Did it go by, you know, oldest first, then working towards the youngest with some other categories of people in between? Systematically, what was the Israeli process for rolling out the vaccine?
The Israeli process was quite typical to Israel. It began as a well-organized campaign, and it became a mess later on.
Right.
But everybody was pushing forward so hard that it was still a success nevertheless. So it began with people over 70, if I'm not mistaken. But as usual in Israel, there were always all those attempts for people to move ahead through the line. And this is what happened, that quite quickly, within, I think, 2 or 3 weeks, their 50s were receiving a first jab. But this was successful, again, because the organizations supplying the jabs were actually very good at what they were doing. I think the record was about a quarter of a million people in one day. So this was moving ahead so quickly that there was no need for a debate. I think by a month's time, even 18-year-olds were receiving the first jab. So the question within a month or 6 or 7 weeks, the question became, why aren't more people willing to receive a jab of vaccines? And not, is this well organized enough? There were quite a lot of complaints in the beginning, but rather quickly it was seen as what it is, as a great success and as a successful campaign that puts Israel in a different place than it was before. But it had political implications as well. It allowed Netanyahu, for the first time, after a year of quite a miserable struggle with the virus and after lots and lots of questions regarding his policy towards the pandemic, it allowed him for the first time to present himself as an actual success. He described this as a success from the beginning, but most of the population were quite skeptic because we saw what a mess it was. Once we arrived at the process of actually rolling out the vaccines, it turned out that he chose the right path, and this was helpful for him politically, although perhaps not as much as he expected.
Right, well, why don't we deal with that now? Because as you mentioned, maybe not as much as he expected. He isn't on course as yet to form a coalition with over 60 seats in the Knesset. And I suppose the question is, number one, why didn't he do better? Or how badly would he have done if these vaccines hadn't been rolled out, if this is the modest achievement he made with the vaccine rollout?
So this is quite interesting. I went with my family to the north of the country the weekend before the elections. That was around March 20th, if I'm not mistaken. And it was quite amazing to see because people were out traveling again. People were visiting restaurants and cafes for the first time. I know, talking to Europeans, this may sound a little strange right now, but Israel is not exactly back to normal. For instance, schools are only partially open and so on. And of course, flights abroad are restricted. But other than that, we even have football spectators back in the stadiums on a limited level. But this has all happened since the beginning of March. It had to do, of course, with the actual positive results, as I said, of the vaccination campaign and with the fact that the numbers of cases were going down. But there was also a very clear political motive for Netanyahu: show the public that normalcy has been resumed and therefore use this to get better results at the polls. And it didn't really materialize that way. I think that he would probably have lost completely but for the success of the vaccination campaign. I think that a large part of the Israeli population is fed up with Netanyahu. He's been in power for ages, for 12 years, as you know, and people want to see him out, especially because he's standing trial, as you know, right now. But the main base of his campaign right now was exactly this. This was not about Iran. This was not about the Palestinians. This was not about him being a tough leader. It was about people back to normal, to normalcy. This isn't exactly true if you compare that to Australia or New Zealand. But yes, indeed, he was quite successful at that. And I think it was surprising for him as well that this didn't work out as much as he planned. Because as you said, if you look at the two blocks right now, the situation is more or less 61 seats to 59 against him. This is not exactly the case because he's still looking for all kinds of deals and he may win in the end and he may be able to establish a coalition of 61 members. But he was hoping for a much better result and relying on the success of the vaccination campaign. It probably saved him, but it didn't help him win completely, as I said, mostly because people are, you know, by this time, people, a lot of the Israeli voters want to see him out, and they're saying, okay, well, you did very well with the vaccines, but let this be your farewell campaign. Let this be your final gesture. We're willing to remember you for this, but go away, enough already.
Right, quit while you're ahead.
Yeah, apparently he's not listening to that, but he has quite a chance of either establishing a new coalition or running for a fifth election. And he doesn't care. By now, you know, it reminds us of Italy in the 80s with all these constant rounds of elections, only, you know, the coffee, the ice cream and the football are not as good as Italy, unfortunately. Right.
And finally, then, to wrap up on a positive note, you mentioned there that your family traveled to the north of the country and that some level of normalcy was returning, if not entirely. So how is that balance working out? How open is the country as the case rates drop and more people become vaccinated? What's the mood like?
The mood is improving. People are happy to be back in the sun and happy to be back in football stadiums. And even the children, some of them are happy to go back to school, although, as I said, this is still limited. We went to a shopping mall a few days ago. We went to restaurants. There are some limits. For instance, the football stadiums, you know, there can only be about 5,000 spectators instead of 30,000 in some of the bigger stadiums in Israel and so on. But this is improving. This is step by step, but it's going on much better than one could assume a few months back when the question of will there be a vaccine was still open. Right now, Israel has achieved a lot of that quite quickly. I think, again, this is time for, once people get used to that, there will be more questions. Why aren't schools completely open? Can we allow more people into restaurants and cafes? What about traveling abroad? Israelis are big fans of tourism. A lot of the country's economy relies on tourism, but it goes the other way around as well. Many, you know, millions of Israelis go abroad usually every summer. So these are big questions, and the economy would take a long time to recover. But other than that, I think the mood is improving. It's nothing like the depression, the general sense of malaise that we felt, I'd say, 3 or 4 months ago, when it was not clear when the vaccines will arrive and when there were so many deaths being counted at hospital ICUs and so on. If you look at the numbers right now, we have somewhere between 8 to 10 deaths a day, and most of them very old people. And 90% of the people who die now in hospitals from COVID are people who haven't received the vaccine. So all of these are, it's not exactly reasons to be cheerful, but it's much better. When you look at the situation in Europe, for instance, I think we're much better off right now. Another issue I should mention, I think, is the what they call the green passport, the vaccine passport.
Oh, yeah.
In most of these places, for instance, I'm trying to describe my own experience because I think it's probably easier for your listeners to identify or to understand where we're at. I went with one of my kids, with one of my sons, to a football game 2 weeks ago. It was Israel, unfortunately, losing to Denmark. But you had to present a document showing that you were vaccinated twice in order to enter the stadium. And in other places, I think in basketball games, there is an option of doing a quick COVID test and showing that you're negative and then entering if you don't have the vaccine. So children, for instance, under 16 are discriminated against, if you'd like, and cannot enjoy that for the time being. Older people who, for some reason, decide not to be vaccinated, there's a limited way for them to enter a restaurant. So in most cases in Israel, it's not that, you know, it's already spring, so people would sit outside. You can get a table outside. You don't need to show that you're vaccinated. But this causes a lot of discussions right now, especially, for instance, kindergarten teachers and so on. Most of them were willing and did receive the second jab already. But there are some cases of kindergarten teachers who are refusing to get that. And then there's a question, will they be fired? Will they be allowed to teach and so on? There are a lot of questions regarding these issues. And I think that most countries in the world will be facing them within a few months. But Israel, as I said, is slightly ahead of the curve because of the vaccination campaign.
Well, that's why it's great to have you on the podcast and be able to, in some ways, to gaze into the crystal ball and look into the future.
A glimpse into the future.
Exactly. Well, I think, unfortunately, while Irish football stadiums are empty at the moment, they may have difficulty filling them anyway, because we too are going through a bit of a bad patch. We had a 1-1 draw with Qatar recently.
Won yesterday. Yesterday evening we won, so for the first time. So
right.
We're just doing a little slightly better right now.
Well, you hold on to that feeling. There's another country starting with an I that's not enduring too much of that at the moment. All right, Amos, listen, thanks a million again for talking to us.
Thank you.
All the best. Have a good one.
Bye.
And that's it for another episode of Pandemic, in which we looked in depth at Israel. From me, Colm O'Mungo, and Chag Pesach Semeach, happy Passover, happy Easter, take care, and thanks for listening.